Eight Nights, copyright 2013 by John Speed.
Night 8. Well, welcome to the last night. Surprise. We haven't done this before. I celebrate the last night of Hanukkah a little differently. I hope that's okay. First, everybody gets a candle on the last night. Mm-hmm. Here's yours. Now, hang on. On the last night, we don't light the candles right away. I keep the room dark for a while, just the light from under the kitchen door and the moon through the window. Tonight, the story comes first, then the light. Well, I told you last night's installment was going to be a bummer. Tonight, we wash away the bitter with the sweet. Tonight, the thrilling conclusion, the miracle, why we've come together. Us and people just like us for the past eight nights, for the past 2,200 years, if it comes down to that. Our Jewish ancestors started this tradition. The miracle took place with Jews in their temple in Jerusalem, but the Jews have never pretended that they own the miracle or that no one else could join in its celebration. Quite the opposite. They've always shared it gladly, even eagerly. Even the Talmud discusses at some length how to make non-Jews feel welcome at Hanukkah. As a non-Jew, I can't adequately express my gratitude for their generosity. Why it's dark. I don't want to have to see your faces right now. I don't want you seeing my face. I'm going to do the thing I hate doing more than anything. I'm going to open my heart to you. It's always pretty painful. I've got a lot to be ashamed of. I keep saying that the story of Hanukkah is my story. This is the part that kills me. When the Maccabees walk through the temple and they see what the Zeus Jews have done to it. The next morning they explored the temple more fully, and the more they looked, the more the sheer dark horror of the desecration grew. There were just so many examples of tawdry, offhand vandalism everywhere, pig shit splashed on walls everywhere, turd, so many tawdry, thoughtless, offhand acts of piggish vandalism. As they saw more and more examples, it began to cloud their minds and freeze their hearts. How do I know this? How do I say this with such certainty? Because I've imagined the scene a dozen times, and I regret to say, I'm ashamed to say, I knew this appalling scene all too well. I saw it in my own dark life. I saw too many direct parallels, absolute parallels, which I'll get to in a moment when I catch my breath. Please give me a moment. And anyway, as the Maccabees looked at these scattered acts of vandalism, other clues started to fall into place. The altar didn't just fall over by itself. The stones of that altar were big, and it took effort, real effort, to knock them down. The Zeus Jews had put some time and planning and teamwork to make that happen. If you wanted to make some excuses for your brother Zeus Jews, to give them an out, to say that they feared for their lives and were splashing pig shit and taking dumps on the tabernacle steps only because they didn't want to die, that broken altar stopped that cold. Those Zeus Jews could have applied that same time and effort and planning and teamwork toward making an escape. They hadn't done that. Those Zeus Jews had knocked down the altar because they wanted to. In fact, it was clear they'd done everything because they wanted to. Those Jews were just sick and tired of being Jews. They were over it. Antiochus had offered them an out, and all they had to do was sacrifice a pig or burn a Torah or take a dump on the tabernacle stairs, and they leaped at the chance. As if with a smear of pig shit, they could make themselves the equal of the Lord who had parted the seas and led their fathers out of Egypt, as if by these tawdry little tantrums they could say, we're done, we're out, Jews no more, no law for us, no covenant, fuck Hashem and the horse he rode in on. I know that's what those Jews were saying, because that's what I've been saying in my own life 2,200 years later when I turned my back on the Lord. I'm ashamed to tell you. That's my story too. There's a second part to this story that's worse than the first, though. You see, when the Maccabees realized how awful the Zeus Jews had really been, when they realized that they'd placed the abomination of desolation in the heart of the tabernacle where the ark had been, while they were shaking their heads at the piggy, tawdry stupidity of their brothers, it dawned on them. They weren't all that great either. What had those Maccabees done, those good guys in this story, the wonderful, faithful Jews, when they found that the pressure was on? They, quite literally, had run for the hills. Sure, they told themselves they had no choice. How could a bunch of weak, defenseless farmers and herders fight a Seleucid army? Well, 3 years later, they had fought back, and they had won. The only difference was, 3 years later, they had trusted in the power of their Lord. What the Maccabees realized was that they might have actually put a stop to all this mess. They might have succeeded. They might. They looked around the desolation of the temple and realized that they shared the blame. Fucking things up is something we all do. What we do afterwards is our real measure. If you're a real fuck-up, you make all kinds of excuses. When I turned my back on the Lord, I too fooled myself into thinking it was something I was forced to do. And of course, it was something I wanted to do. Something I worked at doing. Fucking up was something I loved doing. I too said I couldn't stop myself, when really, I could have stopped any time. And even if I couldn't stop, who did I think I was kidding? I could have at least tried. When I imagine the Maccabees looking at the desolation of the temple, it's no different than me surveying the desolation of my own life, the ruin I had made of it. I know that their hearts at last were broken because my heart at last was broken. I even know what they said finally, when they faced the truth and their hearts were broken. They said what I said. We have fucked things up. We have truly fucked things up. And there is no way we will ever unfuck them. They looked around this holy place. Now broken. Now defiled. They could remember when it was alive with song, when the flame of Shekinah informed each corner, when fire blazed from the altar, when to step into the courtyard meant to step into the living presence of the Lord. Now the place was a wasteland. They themselves had made it so. They had done what they set out to do, and they had no one to blame but themselves. Hashem had left the building. He'd gone home, fried himself a peanut butter and banana sandwich, knocked back a couple of seconds, and gone to bed. He was never coming back. When they came into the full awareness of their shame, the Maccabees could not long stand to stay there. They left the temple. They left Jerusalem and walked to Mizpah, a sacred hill about 4 miles away, which had a watchtower that overlooked Mount Zion. They took off their clothes and covered themselves with ashes and put on sackcloth and said prayers of mourning. Who were they mourning or what? Everything, really. They'd come back to find pretty much everything they thought they loved was dead. their holy city, their temple, their way of life, the law, the covenant too, I suppose. I can tell you from my own experience what this day is like. There's an old, stupid country song. Why does my heart go on beating? Why do these eyes of mine cry? Don't they know it's the end of the world? It ended when you said goodbye. And you try really, really hard to remember that those lyrics are stupid cliches, because at that moment they seem rather profound. In fact, on that day, the tall bridge and the train track and the gas oven and the noose look a whole lot more inviting than the slow ticking hand of the kitchen clock. As much as the Maccabees had hated the confines of the law, the constant fear of the Lord, the endless looking over the shoulder, worrying about Hashem's fearsome wrath, at least life had had a purpose. That great, terrifying world they lived in had been filled with a being who promised good to those who kept his law. At least they'd had that hope. On the other hand, why had Hashem delivered them from the Seleucids? Merely to show them the defiled temple? To rub their noses in their collective sin? To show them the depth of their squalid guilt and then to leave them high and dry? So their thoughts turned to the mess at the temple, and whether to restore it as a place of worship or maybe to restore it simply as a penance with a contrite heart just to make amends. Maybe none of the above. Maybe they should just walk away and call it quits. And after, I am certain, a lot of sad and bitter talk and many tears, at last the Maccabees decided to return and set things right, at least as right as they could. It must have been hard. I can tell you from my own experience. I know their story, those broken-hearted Jews, because, as I keep saying, their story's my own. Going back is hard. Walking up your own steps, knocking on your own front door, waiting for an answer, asking through the closed door to be let in, waiting some more, nearly giving up, hearing finally the click of the door lock opening and then waiting for the door to open, giving up and opening it yourself gently, peeking in, tiptoeing across the doorstep of what used to be your home. That's hard. Seeing the pieces of furniture still lying on the floor just the way you left them, that's hard. You don't even want to lift your eyes for fear you'll see the faces of your loved ones. It's like why I have the lights turned down while I'm saying this to you now. The Jews were going back to the temple they themselves defiled. That was going to be hard. It must have been a pretty brutal task, psychologically speaking, like picking up the body parts of friends after an explosion, something you want to do maybe, but something you dread. Getting out of bed would be harder every day. Like those guys who pick through the rubble of the Twin Towers, who would find an arm or nose or something and would lift it from the rubble while holding their hands over their hearts and gently place it on a plywood board and cover it with an American flag. And on the news, you'd see them turn away, breaking down uncontrollably, and one of their buddies would reach out to hold them. Then a klaxon would go off, and all the workers would line up and stand at attention and salute as that part was carried up from the pit. It would just break your heart. I think it must have been like that. On a practical level, who was involved? The Maccabees men and women and children who'd been living in the country, who had joined with the rebellion but not returned to their homes, most of them farmers and herders, some of them rabbis, some of them, like Judas, Levites, So there were priests, probably a few hundred people altogether. And next, the tasks. Clear away the crap and clutter of the Zeus Jews, tear down the statue of Zeus and its pagan altar, get rid of that gymnasium, or at least block it off from the courtyard, move that loathsome thing out of the tabernacle. I do want to mention that thing they found in the tabernacle, that thing that made everybody gag. I didn't make that up. The Books of Maccabees call it the abomination of desolation, but they don't describe it. It was so horrible, nobody can bear to say what it was, but it must have been a hell of a thing just to come up with a name like the abomination of desolation. Holy cow. What a name. But whatever it was, it totally entered the consciousness of the Jews. Just like we'll refer casually to 9/11, the Jews continued to refer to it for hundreds of years. In the Gospels and in other New Testament books, sort of an iconic reference point of uber disgust. Just how disgusting would that be? Oh, worse than the abomination of desolation. That's how disgusting. And that's what they had to take out of the tabernacle. They had to clean the walls of the temple and the tabernacle, repair the holy vessels, rebuild the altar. It was going to be a lot of work for a few hundred people, months of work probably. And then there was this unspoken question sort of hanging over everything. When all that was done, what then? Seal up everything as a kind of memorial? Or try to start things up again? Nobody wanted to think about that. Not yet. The written accounts are pretty skimpy, the accounts of the cleanup. They talk about removing the abomination. The words are so brief, they scare me. But I do love one passage, though. The Maccabees built a new altar base from unhewn stones. The old stones, they moved to a corner of the courtyard until a prophet should come to tell them what should be done with them. Isn't that wonderful? It means they kicked a lot of ideas around first before they realized it was a decision too big for them to make alone. It's interesting to see that they believed that another prophet might show up. It suggests that their feelings of hope were growing. Watch how that one goes. At one time, I believed that Asheville's local Hasidic rabbi, who's a really terrific guy, might bring his wife by our house for a visit. My wife and I thought we'd serve them some refreshment, so I read up on how to kosher the cooking implements, you know, dishes and silverware and so forth. I mention this because a lot of emphasis is placed on boiling water as a means of purification. So I imagine at the temple, after basic cleaning and repairs were done, a lot of boiling water was used to return items to a state of ritual purity. But in fact, I don't know. There's no record of what was done. And there's no instruction anywhere on how to purify a defiled temple. My wife, who has endured years and years of my droning on and on about this period, however, has some thoughts that I have come to share. She thinks that women played a central role. I've certainly seen something equivalent in Hindu temples, where the priesthood, of course, is all male. So the formal maintenance of a Hindu temple is done by male priests and by a male staff directed by those priests. And everything in a Hindu temple is very clean and very neat because the priests want to do their very best to honor their deity, and they do a good job. But a lot of Hindu temples, particularly temples dedicated to Krishna or to the goddess, those are most frequented by women, and those are quite beautiful, not just clean and neat. In fact, when you go into one, your heart sort of opens up, like on that first bright day of spring when the trees first open up and flower and the sun is bright and gentle, because in those temples, the women have made everything beautiful. Blossoms placed here and there, chalk designs traced on the walkways, garlands hung on photographs, perfume in the air. Women have been there, beauty everywhere. The Hindu gods are happy. Maybe you're fortunate enough to have had a wife or mother who has made your home beautiful and seen this for yourself, how women have this almost magical way of bringing beauty to the places that they love. I don't want to be all sexist here, but I've never seen a man do this. Have you? Maybe some men someplace can do this, but women make this happen all the time. Those little girls with perfect braids, the flowers placed so thoughtfully on the bedside table, the seashells in the glass bowl, you know the sort of stuff I mean. The fact that I say stuff, indicating that I have testicles. As the men were doing the heavy lifting and rough scrubbing, and the temple slowly began to regain its order, I'm sure that the women were not idle. I'm sure that women were bringing beauty. I've learned the hard way that women's love is precious, and that women often express that love by bringing beauty into the world. They do a lot of things, great things, wonderful things, but bringing beauty, that's something they seem particularly good at, something most men seem inept at. For my part, I've come to value it, and I think more and more that men now do as well. I like to think those Maccabee men had come to see that the temple was starting to be beautiful, that it wasn't just being restored, it was being transformed. So the months passed, and eventually there could be no denying that the temple was in a state of readiness. It was suitable to be returned to its use as a place of worship. Originally, I expect there'd been some question, but during all the effort of restoring the temple and with the news of the restoration spreading through the country by now, the question was all but settled. If you restore it, you really have no choice but to return it to its intended use. Of course, some of the Jews would wonder whether the temple hadn't passed the point of no return. How many times could the temple be destroyed and restored and still be the temple? How many times could Hashem bring his presence back? Could he even stand to be present in a temple defiled by his own people? To those who doubted, the believers had an answer. Let's try it and find out. It seems like ages since we talked about the law surrounding the eternal flame of the menorah and the eternal fire of the altar and the preparations of the holy oil, so time for a quick refresher. The altar fire had to burn constantly. Remember, fire from the altar was used to keep the flames of the oil lamps of the menorah lit constantly. The oil from those lamps was olive oil sanctified by staying in the presence of that sacred flame for 7 days and nights. Naturally, things could go wrong, so the priests who made and stored the sacred oil kept a backup supply. The high priest would place a wax seal on bottles of oils that had been sanctified and were ready to go. Remember when the second temple was restored, the Persians returned the menorah and the bottles of sacred oil to the Jews, so when worship started up again, everything was ready? Well, there's an interesting story about the sacred eternal fire of the altar. I told you the story of Jeremiah hiding the Ark of the Covenant. Another story is that Jeremiah took some of the sacred fire from the altar and stored it in a large clay pot. This pot traveled with the Jews to their captivity to Babylon. When plans were being made for the restoration of the temple, the Persians asked to see the content of the fire pot. And when they opened it, the Jews and Persians found that the pot contained a dark, thick liquid. When a scoop of this liquid was placed in the sunlight, it burst spontaneously into flame. The Persians and the Jews called this liquid naphtha, meaning purification. Nehemiah, the first Persian governor of Judea, used this naphtha as the source of the sacred altar fire. So, in that sense, the fire of the second Persian temple was the original eternal fire of the first temple, which was part of the original fire of Moses' tabernacle. But that naphtha had been lost. The fire was gone. So now we come to the day when this altar's fires were to be lit, and the sacrifices to be started, and the worship of Hashem to be started up again. It wasn't a day of requirement, but you can be sure a lot of Jews were at the temple that day. They came into the courtyard and oohed and aahed and remarked about how nicely everything had been restored and really how it looked even better than before. The musicians were playing everybody's favorite psalms, and everyone sang along with the choir, and they cheered as the carts of firewood were rolled to the base of the altar, and as the first sheep and goats were led up to the slaughter tables, everybody shouted and cheered and clapped as Judas stood at the door of the tabernacle and said a few words and thanked all the little people who'd made this day possible. Everyone stood in silence, remembering the Jews who had died rather than give up the faith, and so on. Everybody was willing to get over the fact that there was no ark, and no one anymore knew the sacred name of the Lord, and that the eternal fire had gone out, and they were going to have to start it from scratch. It was going to be okay. In spite of that, everybody agreed. And then the bombshell hit. Somebody noticed the broken seals. Somebody noticed that the seals on the bottles of holy oil that they were going to use for the menorah had been broken. Now, if that idiot had only kept his mouth shut, there would be no Hanukkah. If he'd only kept his mouth shut and just pretended that everything was fine, nobody would have ever known. Sacred oil had no material difference from any other oil. The only thing different was that it was sacred. Those seals, broken or whole, made no difference to the oil inside the bottles. That oil would have burned just fine. But instead, he said something. He said, "Oops." And with that one word, the day changed from one of rejoicing to one of despair. The priests dug through the bottles, broken seal. Some goddamn vandal had broken every seal. They could just picture the piggy little smile on his piggy little face as he ran his fingernail through the wax and tossed the now useless bottle of oil back into the basket, just knowing that this day would come and he would have his little joke. Ha ha! Only one bottle's seal had remained preserved. Enough oil for one day. The Jews' dreams of starting over were fucked. They had fucked things up for good. Hashem had let them play out this whole charade and then pulled the chair out just as they were about to sit down. And bless their broken hearts. Instead of cursing the Lord, cursing their fates, those fierce, brave Jews cowboyed up. They stood tall. Those Jews, those admirable, broken-hearted, hopeless, helpless Jews came to a decision. They decided that even if it was to be only for one day, that they would then worship Hashem for that one day. The priest stepped onto the porch of the tabernacle before the courtyard full of their brothers, and said the words that changed those songs of joy to weeping. When things settled down, they did it. They didn't have any naphtha, so I guess they struck a match or brought fire in a horn or something. Anyway, they closed their eyes and held their breaths, and for better or worse, they did it. One final day of worship. One day, they joined hands together in the temple for their Lord. They lit the sacred fire of the altar. Then they took some of that fire and lit the incense and the oil lamps of the menorah. They sang the blessings. We've been waiting to light our candles. Let's do that now. Let's remember those sweet, helpless, broken-hearted Jews. One last time. Let's light the lights together. Night fell. Slowly, the crowds that had come to rejoice drifted home in sorrow. Everybody went home eventually, except for a few priests idly tending the altar fire. The vast temple was empty and quiet. When the oil of the menorah burned out, those priests would go home too, and the time of the temple would finally end. That the menorah lights still burned the next morning didn't set off any alarms. Probably things only began to seem a little bit strange that afternoon. A little stranger that evening, maybe. By nightfall, rather odd. A few raised eyebrows, some whispers. A couple of priests started sitting in the tabernacle, watching the menorah flames. The next day, a few people from the city began standing outside the tabernacle. From time to time, one of the priests would step outside to give them updates. That night, a few more people came and sat outside to keep vigil. Soon word spread. Over the next few days, the courtyard grew more crowded. In front of the tabernacle, in the courtyard of musicians, singers sometimes sat and sang. By the next morning, music began playing around the clock. Singers had to sign up for times. By the end of the sixth day, people from all over Israel were trekking to the temple. The courtyard was jammed. Feeding people became a concern. In the end, people didn't mind sharing. It was like a party. The courtyard was full of lights, even by day. By night, it was an astonishing sight. The courtyard blazing with 100,000 tiny flames. Everyone was waving lights at the tabernacle as if encouraging the menorah. All night and all the next day, people sang at the top of their lungs. People shouted prayers to Hashem. The priests struggled to remember the exact hour and minute that the menorah had been lit. When they'd lit it, they just assumed that the jig was up. They never realized how important that exact time would be. Now they didn't want to miss the moment that the oil that was bathing in the sacred light would be consecrated and ready to be used. 8 days after the sacred fire was lit, Judas, looking weary and bedraggled, stumbled through the tabernacle doors. He didn't say a thing. He didn't need to. He just held up a couple of the clay bottles of the newly sanctified oil, the red wax of their new seals still hot and dripping onto his fingers. It took a moment for the crowd to realize what they were seeing. And then the courtyard exploded in cheers. Grown men fell to their knees and wept. The Talmud is quite emphatic that the Hanukkah menorah is to be placed outside so everyone can see the lights. The second option, which is much less desirable, is for the menorah to be placed in a window in full view of the street. There's no other Jewish celebration so emphatically public as Hanukkah. The Jews wanted everyone to know that they could share in the great miracle. From the start, they wanted everyone to realize it wasn't just about the Jews. There are some events that are about humanity, discovering fire, the first wheel, walking on the moon. Individuals of genders, ages, tribes, religions, races, individuals of genders, ages, tribes, religions, races, nationalities, and so on did these things. But those traits are meaningless, really. Humans did them. It was Jews who lit the temple lamps, of course, and Jews who have kept the memory alive ever since. But they've never stressed that part. They've seen it as a blessing on all humanity. They've never said, hands off Jews only. With Hanukkah, anyone can play. Everyone is welcome. The more the merrier, actually. So now we've come to it. I've been saying since forever that my story is the story of the great miracle. And how many times have I said, don't think the sign is the miracle? And how many times have I said, holy cow, when I tell you about the great miracle, your head is going to explode, and so on. For 8 nights, I've been diligently, enthusiastically painting myself into this quarter, and now I have no choice. Boy, oh boy, I hope I'm up to this. I imagine that this is how Judas felt when he lit the altar fire. I imagine, in fact, that this is exactly how Judas felt. When I say the story is my story, this is what I mean. I say now, as Judas said 2,200 years ago, well, here goes nothing. You've heard the story of the sign. Now I'll tell you the story of the miracle. You've been listening to this story, and how many times have I said Hashem is a developing character? He's changing. I told you that sweet quote from Rabbi Nachman that the Lord constantly gives us hints. The story of Hashem and his people, the story I've been telling these last 8 nights, is full of hints. You need to remember back to our first night together, to the first time Hashem caught Abram's attention, how he was lonesome. Yes, lonesome, unworshipped, and unloved. And the only way he could think to get Abram's undivided attention was to cut a deal. When Hashem was a miserable, childish desert god who couldn't touch people's hearts, who would just bring plagues and storms to make things happen. I said he was throwing tantrums. I told you I said that without meaning disrespect, and you thought, oh, he's being a wise ass. But I know about tantrums. I'm a dad. I had a son who threw tantrums, and it was rough on everyone. But my son grew up to be a wonderful man. Children who throw tantrums grow up. Hashem grew up. Hints. I've littered this story with his hints. Hashem cut his deal with a bunch of desert nomads, and I'll bet he regretted it almost immediately. I remarked on how Hashem felt regret. Remember, I asked whether you ever thought about that. That was a hint. These nomads weren't all that great when Hashem cut the deal, and almost immediately they ended up in a big mess, carted away into slavery in Egypt. That childish, tantrum-throwing nature god had to do everything he could think of to help them out. He pulled every gimmick he could out of his modest bag of tricks. He couldn't even find a willing helper. The best he could find was a guy who tried to argue his way out of it. Remember that? A guy who told Hashem, in effect, that he was making bad choices. It took a lot of growing up for Hashem to stick with his covenant. How many times did he think, wait a minute, I'm the all-powerful Lord of Hosts. What a disaster to be stuck with this rabble. I'm out of here. Adios, muchachos. But he hung in there. That scene in the desert when Hashem appeared as Shekinah and the fire and smoke around Mount Sinai, that was a big deal. That moment was Hashem trying really, really hard to be a grown-up and talk grown-up to grown-up with the Jews he just saved from Pharaoh's slavery. Look, he said, I'm the Lord. I brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. But what can I say? I'm a jealous God. It's my nature. Just how it is. Please, I'm serious. Have no other gods before me. If he'd said something like this, at couples counseling, at that point he'd be reaching for the tissues. The other nine commandments he wrote by fire on tablets of stone were, like I said, guidelines for a nice life. But that one, and only that one, was a personal plea, a serious and heartfelt relationship request. That was the hard one, a hard truth that would be hard for anyone to say, maybe even harder for a god. Yet Hashem had manned up and said his piece. Hashem had hoped, even believed, I think, that his chosen people were growing up too, just like him. Like people at the couples counselor revealing their hard personal truths, hoping their spouses were ready to hear. He had opened his heart. Unfortunately, Hashem had matured faster than the Jews. Hashem had mastered honesty and openness. His jealousy, not so much. That whole golden calf thing really threw him. He started treating the Jews like bad children. Their whole 40 years in the desert thing, the whole 673 commandments, visiting the sins of the fathers unto the third and fourth generation. Like an angry, bitter spouse. If he couldn't get a decent grown-up partnership out of them, then by heaven, Hashem would sure as hell show the Jews who the fuck was boss. Did you see the hints in this story? Hashem tried to have a partnership of equals. That blew up in his face. So he became the bad dad. And that relationship went on for a long, long time. The thing is, all those great Santini rules and regulations sort of worked out well for the Jews. Hashem, as a cosmic drill sergeant, was indeed a heavenly pain in the ass, but the Jews, frankly, kind of needed structure to grow up, and the law provided it. The Jews slowly began to mature, which is why I next bring up the story of the kings, of Saul and David and Solomon. My choice of those stories is another hint. This part of the story is a lot like the teenager asking for some freedom, asking, as it were, for the car keys. It's a moment when both the child and the parent come to a point of change. The child needs to step up, and the parent needs to accept the child's new maturity and let go, which Hashem did. It's the classic story, too. It's all fun and games until somebody crashes the car. The Jews got their kings, and within a few years, they started putting idols in the temple, right in the living room of the jealous Lord. Hashem had grown up in the interim. He took his lumps. He was like the sad, mature dad who lets the teenager get picked up by the cops and face the music on his own. He just let the Jews get taken to Babylon. When I say this story is my story, by the way, as you probably have guessed, I see specific parallels with this relationship of Hashem and his people, and my relationship to my parents, my children, my dear wife, and my higher power. When I say this story is your story, it's because it is your story too. I know that to be true, because that same divine spark informs all of us. That same desire for love, for growth, for freedom, that same jealousy, idolatry, and rebellion and disaster pulses through our lives and our relationships, building them up and tearing them down constantly. The hints in this story are hints for everyone. That's why the Jews created Hanukkah. It's why they've lit the lights for all to see for 2,200 years. Just like a kid in prison grows up fast, the Jews in Babylon did too. It was a really remarkable change. You don't have to be in a physical prison to run into life-saving wisdom like the 12 steps. I wasn't. But a lot of people do. That's when a lot of people first face their problems squarely, first take a moral inventory, first ask their higher power for help, first try to make amends. There are hints in that part of the story, too. For the first time, the Jews stopped simply observing the specifics of the 673 commandments. They wanted, for the first time, to understand them. They wanted, for the first time, to go beyond them, to act not simply to avoid bad consequences, but to please their Lord. That must have been a nice change of pace for Hashem. I think that's when he decided to send them home. And now we come to the bitter part of the story, the part of my story that makes me feel the saddest. When they came back to Jerusalem, the Jews had made some giant strides. They had really grown up. The second temple was the all-grown-up temple, which makes their fall so much more horrible. A kid makes bad choices and you get over it. He's just a kid. The grown-up makes bad choices, and it's a lot harder to take. Those are thoughtful choices, made despite the consequences, made aware of the consequences. Those bad choices really hurt. The Jews made the golden calf, Hashem realized, were children. He got over it. He embraced his children. He took care of them. The Jews who defiled the temple were grown-ups. They knew better. They knew better. And they went to hell and did it anyway. They were no different than I was. I did exactly that. And I woke up one day to discover what the Jews discovered. That Hashem had just the hell had it. That he had given up on me. With good reason. I'd always assumed that he would be there for me, but one day he was gone. I had fucked things up. I had totally fucked things up, and I was more alone than I had ever known that I could be. Now, I was fortunate, as the Maccabees were fortunate, to have around me some influences that kept me focused. I faced the same questions they faced as they realized the extent of the fuck-up, the full impact of their desolation. And that is, what are you going to do about it? All that I personally could do was to tell my higher power, wherever he had gone, that I finally now realized how blindingly stupid I had been. With no hope of forgiveness, I asked his forgiveness. I promised to try to make things right. I promised to amend my life. Like them, I knew it was all hopeless. I didn't blame Hashem for leaving. He hadn't asked for much. Just that I have no other gods before him, and I wouldn't even give him that. I'd cluttered up my life with every fucking idol that I could find. I'd splashed pig shit on the temple walls. The final step of manhood, I think, is doing the right thing when you know it to be hopeless. These are the acts we remember and honor, the acts that break our hearts when we retell them, the acts that inspire us. Cleaning up the defiled temple was such an act. I bless the Jews who did this. I took courage from their example. But the real moment that inspired me, the one that makes me weep each time, was the moment of complete despair they faced. The moment when they realized that the whole effort had been for nothing. When they found the broken seals on the bottle of oil, that's when they realized that the temple would never be restored, that they had managed to fuck things up so utterly that they could never be made right. And yet, despite that utter certainty of failure, the Jews decided to light the temple fire. Hopeless and helpless, with no thought of gain. Just because. Just because. Because they realized they loved the Lord and they were sorry. Being sorry. That was new. Remember how I mentioned that the Lord never asked for anyone to be sorry for sin? Only for the proper expiation? But those Jews had finally grown up. That decision showed the depth of their contrition, and so they went ahead, in spite of everything, and lit the fire and flames. One final time, they couldn't do much, but they could at least do that. They could at least do that. Out of love. Out of love. Out of love. That hopeless, courageous, selfless, loving act marked change of heart. The miracle, part one. How can a decision be a miracle? Well, a miracle is when something unexplainable happens. And for 3,000 years, the Jews, like everyone on earth, I suppose, had been approaching the divine like a big celestial Skinner box, pressing the lever and hoping to get a sugar pill instead of a shock. But that day, they did what they did, knowing full well that the box was unplugged and nothing would come out of it at all. So how unexplainable was that? Today, what makes me happiest about the Maccabees' decision is how utterly impossible it is to explain that decision to anyone who doesn't already love the Lord. I adore the look of complete confusion. Is it wrong of me to think the Jews began to celebrate Hanukkah because, in part, they had a wicked sense of humor? And now, the second part. The part that fulfills the great miracle. The one we shared, remembered all these generations, why we light these lights and weep. When, with hopeless love, his children lit those lights, the Lord himself, in spite of everything, turned his face on them. On me. On us. All through the story, the Lord appears as fire. Great balls of fire. But this time, he returns and the flame of his presence is gentle. The flickering light of an oil lamp that just won't stop burning. I think not ever. After 2,400 years of fire, of anger, of plague and flood and thunder, the Lord returned to his children as a quiet, ever-burning light, as if to say, "It's okay, I'm here." And parents and couples, they call this unconditional love, 2,400 years of consequences. But that night, the Lord returned with quiet forgiveness, with the sign of a gentle flame that did not fail. For the Lord so loved the world. That night the Lord returned with love. He saw the desperate courage of his children, their hopeless, pathetic courage, and their contrition, and their selfless love. And he wept for them, and he forgave them. He came back. Why we remember that night, year after year, generation after generation. That night, everything changed. From then on, his love would be there just for the taking. You wouldn't have to eat anything special, or say any special words, or go to a special building, or live in any special way. His love would just be there. And from that night on, you could just reach out and take it. That's the Hanukkah miracle, the new covenant. On that dark night, the new covenant began. And if that doesn't break your heart tonight, just wait. Some dark night, some horrible night, when you've fucked up everything, when you're standing knee-deep in a puddle of your own shit, crying out in despair, when you are desolate and in darkness, remember. When you are utterly alone, you can still reach out to him. No matter how big the fuck up. No matter how deep the shit. It doesn't matter if you've lost the secret name. Just call out anything. It doesn't matter if the sacred fire has gone out. Any spark will do. The Lord, in his mercy, accept bad coin. The Lord, in his mercy, accepts bad coin. That spark will somehow burst into flame in your heart. By his will, not yours. Don't worry. Even if you're out of gas, he'll provide that too. I know it's true because I know it's true. My sincere wish is that you never need to find out for yourself, but if you do, if you have to live through the hard parts of the story, like I did, hang in there. Remember this. I promise you, it's true. You can't be sure of much in life, but you can be sure of that. It didn't used to be like that. That's the miracle. On that night of dedication, that night of Hanukkah, everything changed. You can never fuck up so much that I will leave you, saith the Lord of hosts. That's the miracle. By the faith and courage and dedication of our ancestors, the old covenant came to its end. The new covenant began. To mark that moment, we join the men and women who have lit these lights and sung these blessings for so many centuries to remember and share the story and never, ever to forget. That's the great miracle of Hanukkah. Shalom. And now I need a tissue.